morning and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today, our topic is the potential for nuclear technology to answer Alaska's diverse energy needs. Given that we are an oil and gas energy state, that's an interesting proposition. From the get-go, it's important to acknowledge that collectively, the general public has reservations about nuclear energy. I need only mention Chernobyl and the Fukushima disasters to make that point. In addition, Alaskans remember Project Chariot, the Atomic Energy Commission's 1958 proposal to create a harbor at Cape Thompson on the North Slope by detonating a string of nuclear devices. Though championed by Edward Teller, also known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, Alaska Native and environmental resistance halted the project. And then there's Amchitka, populated for 2,500 years by Aleut people. In the late 60s and 70s, it became the site for three underground nuclear detonation tests, equally unpopular with environmental groups. Testing was halted, and the site is still monitored for radioactive leaking. So where are we today? Why is nuclear energy again under serious consideration? What new technical developments have occurred that might change the perception that it is dangerous? And what particular role might Alaska play as nuclear energy, with its zero emissions, comes under closer scrutiny for the modern world? We have three guests with us today, all who can really illuminate a lot about this topic for us. We have two Alaskans and one person calling in from the Idaho National Laboratory in Idaho Falls. So let me welcome Gwen Holdman. She's the Executive Director for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power out of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. Welcome, Gwen.
Thank you, Kathleen. I'm excited to be here today.
Happy to have you. I think we might have had you on one other program a while back.
Yes,
that's what we've never met face-to-face. Once again, we are on the phone. In fact, all of our guests are on the phone, partly because of COVID and partly because several of them are not in Anchorage. I'd also like to welcome Rochelle Johnson. She's the lead analyst for the UA Center for Economic Development's recent report on nuclear energy in Alaska. And that is housed with the UAA Alaska Enterprise Institute. Welcome, Rochelle.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
And glad to have you. And then Dr. John Jackson is the National Technical Director for the Department of Energy Micro Reactor Program at the Idaho National Laboratory. So welcome, Dr. John Jackson.
Thanks, Kathleen. It's my pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
I really appreciate it. Since I don't have a background in this at all, I really appreciate all three of you joining us, because it seems like an important time for Alaskans to come up to speed, I guess you would say, on developments in nuclear technology, and actually to take a look at how they might fit with Alaska, because we're not just one size fits all here. We have a lot of different kind of communities, a lot of different geography, a lot of different energy needs. So it'll be really interesting to sort of take a look at this with the three of you. Let me just give you a little bit longer bio on each of our guests, just because I think it lets you know how much they know about the topic we're going to talk about. So Gwen is the founder and director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, an applied energy research program based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which focuses on community-scale fossil and renewable / alternative energy technologies. Specific areas of emphasis include power systems integration for microgrids, hydrokinetic energy, low temperature geothermal, and diesel efficiency. Prior to joining the University of Alaska, Gwen worked in the private sector as a design engineer and project manager, including the design and construction of the only operational geothermal power plant in Alaska at Chena Hot Springs. Gwen has been inducted into the Alaska Innovators Hall of Fame and was selected as a member of Alaska's top 40 under 40. In 2015 and 16, she served as a Fulbright scholar as part of the Arctic Fulbright Initiative. Gwen lives in an off-grid home with her family and 35 dogs using a combination of solar, wind, battery storage, diesel generation, and wood heat. She has competed in the Yukon Quest and Iditarod sledding races. Oh, my goodness, Gwen. you have a bachelor's in mechanical engineering from Bradley University, and your master's is from the Geophysical Institute at UAF. So welcome, Gwen. And now I'm going to introduce Rochelle. As I said in the brief introduction, Rochelle is the lead analyst at the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Prior to joining that center, Rochelle worked with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, the Alaska Energy Authority, and the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference, where she worked with rural communities to solve energy and development issues. As a lifelong Alaskan, she is passionate about economic development in our communities. Her professional interests include energy policy and development, rural development, and discovering ways to use the strengths of our communities to create new opportunities. Rochelle holds a Bachelor's of Arts in Economics from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Again, welcome, Rochelle, and so glad to have you. And let me then just share a little bit about Dr. John Jackson's a background. Dr. Jackson is a distinguished staff scientist slash engineer at the Idaho National Laboratory in Idaho Falls, Idaho. He currently has dual responsibility as the gateway for accelerated innovation in nuclear technical interface and as the industry program lead for the Nuclear Science User Facility. In these capacities, John works closely with the Department of Energy Office of Nuclear Energy and the nuclear industry to ensure that DOE facilities are used effectively to maintain the current reactor fleet and to enable innovation. John has nearly 20 years of experience in the area of mechanical testing and fracture mechanics. He also has over 3 years of experience in extreme environment materials characterization and drilling mechanics at the ExxonMobil Upstream Research Company in Houston, Texas. John holds a doctorate and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Washington, Seattle, and a BS in mechanical engineering technology from Central Washington University, also in Washington State. So welcome to all three of you. And just before we got on the air, I thought, well, let me just ask them, do they come to this program as advocates for nuclear energy or just the search for information? And I asked each of them, and they do come to it from different places. So let me start with you, Dr. Jackson. Tell us how you approach and what your thoughts are about nuclear energy. Are you a proponent or just a student of it?
So I would consider myself a proponent of nuclear energy. That said, I also recognize the necessity for an all-of-the-above solution. So while I am definitely a proponent of nuclear energy, I recognize that there are other energy sources, all of which need to work together for us to have a clean future in the United States of America.
Okay. And how about you, Gwen, and then we'll get to Rochelle. Do you come as a student, or do you come as an advocate for nuclear energy, or a kind of all of the above?
Yeah. No, I really appreciate that. No, I would definitely say if you're going to put it into those sorts of buckets, Kathleen, I would consider myself to be more of a student of nuclear energy. At the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, we try really hard to be pretty technology agnostic. We're sort of looking at all of the different options that might be part of Alaska's energy mix either today or at some time in the future. And that's really where we're coming to it from. And this is how we've become interested in nuclear energy, because I do see a role for nuclear energy, first of all, globally. I would certainly agree with Dr. Jackson there. But in Alaska, you know, I think that there could be a role, especially as you're seeing these smaller reactor technologies that we're going to be talking about, I think, a little bit later on in the show. I am interested in understanding how nuclear energy could fit as part of Alaska's future energy mix. So I see myself as a student of the technology.
Gotcha. And how about you, Rochelle? What's your take?
I would say I am also probably a student of the technology. Prior to a couple of years ago, I had no experience with nuclear. So this project was kind of my introduction to it. And I came at it from an angle of trying to understand what the energy market is in Alaska and how energy technology decisions are made by energy producers, and what matters when you're thinking about nuclear in that context for Alaska. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And we'll get into more detail because, as I said in our introduction, there's not just one sort of energy need in Alaska. There's a lot of different kinds, and we'll learn more about how nuclear has some potential for different areas in Alaska. So, Dr. Jackson, I'm going to start with you because I opened this saying, gosh, people think of Fukushima, they think of Chernobyl, and here in Alaska, Amchitka and, you know, Project Chariot. But there's that was one era of the nuclear age, and a lot has changed, and a lot is still under development. So I'm just sort of hoping you can take us to the present moment in nuclear technology development. You are the technical director of the micro reactor program at Idaho National Lab. So give us a little bit of an overview of where we are now with nuclear technology.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. So it's important to frame the evolution of nuclear energy in time, perhaps. We've had 70 or more years of experience in nuclear energy, and you know, within the past several decades, the conversations surrounding the implementation of advanced nuclear have increased in volume and magnitude. So, what we found, you know, particularly within the last decade, for example, is a growing desire to innovate in nuclear energy, in the nuclear energy industry. For example, in 2015, an NGO called Third Way published a report indicating that there were 50 or more nuclear developers in the spectrum of energy in the United States. And that's very exciting because what they're focused on is so-called advanced nuclear, which is really, you know, if there's perhaps one distinguishing character, there are multiple distinguishing characteristics, but one that stands out is innovation with a purpose in mind, and this is perfectly captured by microreactors, where we're innovating to develop very small focused energy sources, you know, for specific applications. But it's important to remember that there are also many concepts, other concepts being developed, small modular reactor concepts, for instance, and several different technologies. So we have a lot to choose from, and I think it's a particularly exciting time. We have broad bipartisan support in politics, you know, for nuclear energy.
That's important. I'm also thinking that climate change may push this to the foreground. It's my understanding that there's zero emissions from nuclear energy generation, and we're living in an era when we have a deadline to try to get our emissions down. So that, and I, when I think about, and I'm going to draw you in, Gwen and Rochelle, in rural Alaska, they have experienced you know, climate change. Some, you know, rural communities have been forced to move or are on the brink of having to move. So, you know, the idea of the fact that the climate is really dramatically changing and we can't ignore it might be very persuasive in some rural communities. So let me go to Gwen and then we'll follow with Rochelle. Just give me a sense of, you know, why about the developments in nuclear technology and why that might be significant in Alaska. Gwen.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. I think there's this really interesting juxtaposition between sort of some of these global issues that we're facing that relate to energy, like climate change, and then kind of looking at these sort of more local issues that we see, especially in many of our small rural communities, you know, that are often located in areas where there's a lot of, that are environmentally sensitive, where people are still really reliant on the land and participate in subsistence activities that depend on having an environment that's not somehow contaminated, right? And so there's sort of this like interesting sort of balance that I feel that we in Alaska are sort of striving for, where we're looking at this sort of broader sort of, you know, these bigger issues that are very much impacting Alaska. As you mentioned, you know, we are sort of seeing these early effects of climate change pretty dramatically, especially along some of our coastlines and some of our rural communities. But at the same time, trying to figure out, know, we use such a little amount of energy in these places. The small amount of carbon that we might be releasing with status quo technologies is such a drop in the bucket when we're looking at things on sort of a global basis. So to what extent do people in rural Alaska have an obligation or responsibility to try to seek low carbon or no carbon sources of energy versus looking at this as a broader sort of question? And then to what extent do we really look at the economics where we say energy costs are very expensive, we're importing energy along potentially vulnerable supply lines? You know, there's a lot of different reasons why we might want to look at alternatives to the status quo, and different people have different personal, you know, rationale for seeking, you know, different approaches to energy. But I think that there's a real belief that we need to find new and different and better solutions, especially for our high-cost rural communities.
And by the way, Gwen, it was a part of authoring a new study that we'll talk about a little bit more, some findings as they relate to Alaska. And also, Rochelle was also part of a study and was the lead analyst. And so we will be delivering more information from their studies as the program goes on. Let me just tell folks, if you've just joined us, we are talking about the potential for nuclear technology to answer some of the needs in Alaska, and Alaska being a place that is not one size fits all. We have, you know, as Gwen was saying, small rural communities that don't really use a lot of energy, but they really need what they get. And but we've also got military bases. We have the rail belt, which is, you know, very developed. We have hub communities. You know, we have communities where during the fishing season, there's a great need for energy for sort of seafood processing, but it might not be a year-round need. And also mining continues to be an active pursuit in Alaska, and the ability for a small-scale energy delivery system in a rural area might be significant for mining. So that's why we're talking about it. I do invite questions from our audience, or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and I'll try to get those questions out to our guests. You can also call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage, and statewide the number is 1-888-353-5752. Again, we have lots of information to get through, and if you just want to listen, that's fine, because I read these reports, and as I told our guests, my brain is popping with the details, and I want to try to share that with you as much as I can. I think it's important for Alaskans to be able to realize this is potentially on the horizon and to educate yourself about it, so that you perhaps aren't thinking about the old style of nuclear energy that we think of when we think of that. So, and one other thing, there's another opportunity locally in Anchorage and basically online. It's a Zoom public event coming up later this week at Thursday on April 15th from 11:30 to 1 o'clock, so around the lunch hour. You could dial in and get, you know, an opportunity to hear more about the potential and the barriers and the challenges of nuclear energy in Alaska. So you can find a link. It's going to be on Facebook. It's going to be easy to access, like we do Zoom meetings these days. But the details are on alaskapublic.org/hometown. And if you go to today's show and just scroll down to, you see the link Zoom public event, you will be able to click in there. So I do think it, again, my goal in the show today is really to share what we know about nuclear energy and hope that Alaskans can become informed, because this may be a decision that they have to make coming up. So let's see, Rochelle, I was just going to go to you to talk a little bit about Alaskans and maybe how they might be thinking about nuclear energy in the future.
Yeah, so I think Gwen kind of hit the nail on the head earlier of speaking to the climate change aspects. A lot of our communities and energy utilities are really highly dependent on fossil fuels, diesel in rural areas, natural gas in urban Alaska, and even coal in urban Alaska. But I like to say, I guess, that the energy producers across the state are like actively pursuing different alternatives and investing in new technologies and looking for alternatives to get them off of diesel. And so throughout our work in this area, I think the line that we have heard across Alaska is that people are interested. They're happy to listen and they're happy to learn. And I think given that the technology is in such new stages right now, we're looking at a long-term timeline for when nuclear may or may not be a reality for Alaska. And now's the time for Alaskans to be able to put their foot forward and say what they want and say what will work for them. In my opinion, this is Alaskans' opportunity to have a voice on their energy future.
Right, to get in on the ground floor. We need to take a tiny break. We have gone through the first 20 minutes of our show, and I need to take a little break. We'll be right back to pursue more details on the future of nuclear technology in Alaska. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We're talking about the future of nuclear technology as an energy source in Alaska, potentially in the future. Studies are being done right now, one by a center up at UAF and another by a statewide center that is located at UAA. And so today's show is kind of prompted by those studies, and the time is right for Alaskans to learn what the pros and cons, the barriers, the values might be with nuclear energy. And our guests are Gwen Holdman with the UAF Center for Alaska Center for Energy and Power, Rochelle Johnson with the UA Center for Economic Development, and Dr. John Jackson, who's the National Technical Director for the Department of Energy Idaho National Lab. Dr. Jackson actually works on a micro reactor development project. So those are going to figure significantly in our discussion. So we'll have Dr. Jackson help us understand how those work. I'm going to welcome a caller on just because when people have a question, I really like to get them answered. And I'd like to welcome Mike onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. How's everyone today?
Hanging in there. It's Monday.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So there are two points I'd like to bring up regarding transportation and all other energy needs. In regards to transportation, I've never really understood, other than the need to get away from fossil fuels and carbon emissions to go to electric vehicles. But my question is, what happens to all the batteries? I don't know of any battery that lasts for really long time. They all die and they all have harmful chemicals. So I can't understand why the conversation hasn't been on hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells for transportation. And now when it gets to all other energy needs, nuclear is a great topic. And the main thing I wanted to bring up with your guests is I was curious if anyone had ever heard of a company called Archimedes Technology Group. It was running in the early 2000s. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Carl Umstadter who was leading that project. And they had developed a method by which to reduce nuclear waste by up to 75 to 80%. And at the time that the project was defunded, he had already had a working model of the process. and was able to show that the process can work. And then the project was, you know, the funding was pulled for whatever reason. That was around 2003. So I would just like to hear your guest comments on the potential for
hydrogen,
reducing nuclear waste. I know that's most people's concern. And then also the micro nuclear power and regeneration. I know there's like fifth and sixth generations of nuclear fuel cells and things like that. So it's a lot safer now, and I just don't think that the word is getting out there. And that was basically my comment.
Yeah. Okay. I'm tempted to go to you, Dr. Jackson, to answer that. Did you know about the Archimedes hydrogen? Is that something that you're aware of?
That's one I'm not familiar with, Kathleen.
Okay. Okay. And I don't know whether you are, Gwen or Rochelle.
That would be
a
no for Michelle.
I'm not specifically familiar.
Oh,
yeah.
Go ahead, Gwen. I know it's hard. We're not in the studio together. Go ahead, Gwen.
No. Yeah, I'm not specifically familiar with the Archimedes system, but I can say, you know, there are a lot of these different technologies that are, you know, coming down the lines. And no matter how we look at it, our energy mix is going to look different in the future. You know, Mike alluded to electric vehicles. What's going to happen at the end of life of electric vehicle batteries? That's a really excellent question, because with all of this, we need to be thinking about sort of the whole life cycle of these different technologies, whether that's a micro reactor and we're looking at what we're going to do with spent nuclear fuel, or whether we're looking at some of the, you know, potentially hazardous materials in electric vehicle batteries. And I can say, actually, on that point, which I do have some familiarity with, you know, we are actually reusing those batteries in Alaska right now. We have several communities in Alaska that are pushing above 100% penetration of wind energy, and they are using refurbished electric vehicle batteries in communities like Kongiganak, for example, in southwestern Alaska, that are able to turn off their diesel generators for days on end, seven days or so at most, when there's wind available, and are able to use the battery and a refurbished EV battery as sort of that buffer between the wind energy and the grid needs and requirements, the loads basically of the consumers on that particular system. So in the future, there's a lot of expectation that those batteries will be repurposed and recycled, that up to 75% of the materials in those batteries will be reused and put into new batteries at the end of their life. And I think that, and this is where Dr. Jackson might be able to chime in here, that's true for nuclear energy as well. You know, mm-hmm. There's really this more and more of this opportunity to reuse and recycle nuclear fuel. And a lot of these small micro reactors are actually expected to use recycled fuel, so to speak, and these TRISO fuels that I'm sure Dr. Jackson can speak quite a bit about. That are quite different from sort of what our legacy reactors are using today, for example.
Yeah. I remember from reading about that in the reports that were produced by the Alaska Center for Energy and Power and the Center for Economic Development. There was reference to recycling and reusing spent nuclear. So to you, Dr. Jackson, help us understand is that a reality? Is that in the development stage? This idea that we might be able to recycle spent nuclear waste.
So first of all, it's very important to understand that, you know, particularly for a micro reactor, the anticipated amount of waste is very small compared to conventional reactors due to their relative size. And I think Gwen kind of got at that, which scales roughly with power and also the design efficiency in these modern concepts. There are definitely, you know, several concepts that allow recovery of fuel and additional utilization of used fuel. So it's a totally different game than the historical fleet. That's not to say that the historical fleet is unsafe in any way, shape, or form, but from a fuel utilization standpoint, microreactors in particular are very, very efficient. The TRISO fuel or tristructural isotropic is a very incredibly safe fuel concept where very small amounts of uranium are encapsulated in graphite and silicon carbide, almost, this is a very, very, very simple analogy, but sort of like envision an egg with a shell and yolk and white. But yes, microreactors in particular are designed to allow recovery. And this ties in with the fact that they're factory built and would be potentially factory processed, you know, following the need to refuel.
Mm-hmm. I saw reference to the microreactors almost as if kind of like they were like almost like a battery, right? You know, like the energy is installed and they can run for something like 20, well, maybe three, maybe it was 3 years. I can't remember. But there was a period of time where you don't really refuel them. And once the energy is spent, the whole unit might get shipped back to the manufacturer. So could you talk a little bit about that? And I guess the TRISO, is the TRISO the sort of recycled nuclear waste that's being transformed into something different? So that was two questions. One about the microreactor as a battery, and the second one about the TRISO being from recycled nuclear waste. Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, I think a battery analogy is a little bit simplistic, but it's perhaps useful to consider it in that form. But you know, again, the point to stress is that fuel, the fuel designs for microreactors in particular and small modular reactors are recoverable, and then can be further processed to be reused in refueling reactors. And yes, it certainly ties in with the fact that these are factory built systems and can be reprocessed at original facilities. TRISO is uranium at its core. It could potentially be from recovered fuel, but TRISO actually refers to a fuel system concept, and these can be are typically formed into. You know, baseball-sized pebbles, if you will, which consist of many, many, many of these little spheres of TRISO particles. They're designed to be completely accident-resistant, meaning that the containment, which is integral to the fuel, can't melt down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think I hope we answered your question, Mike. He's gone now, but I'm anxious to kind of move into the reports. I have one more question from a listener who, and this is probably a Gwen or a Rochelle question. Actually, I know I came upon the information about the nuclear facility at Fort Greeley, and we have a caller who's just or an email guest who's just asking us whatever happened to that small nuclear power plant that was tested in Galena. Can Rochelle or Gwen give us a little update on the when it was used and what happened to it?
Yeah, I think I'm probably, this is Gwen. Rochelle, I think I'm probably the right one to take that question, I'm guessing. You know, and this report that you've been referencing that you took a look at, Kathleen, is not our first report that we put together on
right.
nuclear energy. And we actually put together a report in 2010 that actually details quite a bit of this history of nuclear energy use or proposed use in Alaska. And so, you know, the only nuclear power plant that was ever actually installed in Alaska was actually installed at Fort Greeley back in the late 60s. And it was actually it was operational for a few years. It was a 2-megawatt reactor. It was an Army project. Dr. Jackson might think of these as like the SM-1A reactor types. There was one installed at McMurdo in Antarctica that was sort of a sister system to the one in Alaska. And that was actually decommissioned after a few years. And frankly, it was actually because of some kind of chloride cracking that they saw in the system in McMurdo, that there was some concern about the long-term integrity of these systems. But it really wasn't, as far as we can tell, any sort of an accident or any kind of a release of nuclear material that caused the shutdown of that system. That was the only operational reactor that was ever installed in Alaska. The system that you're referring to, which is this Toshiba 4S proposed 10-megawatt reactor for Galena, Alaska, was also basically what I guess I would call kind of a paper reactor. Like, it was a conceptual reactor technology, and Galena was a community at that point in time. The Air Force still had a presence there, so there was a larger electric load and heat load than it does today. And so there was this idea of potentially placing this 10-megawatt small nuclear reactor in Galena. And there was actually a lot of discussion about that. There was actually a lot of dialogue with the National the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There was a series of papers that were white papers that were put together discussing various elements of some kind of a deployment in Alaska. And in many ways, this was sort of the birth of like sort of this new idea of these small micro reactors and this idea of placing them in either civilian or defense sort of applications in more remote areas. And so as I understand it, it really kind of moved the discussion forward a bit at the national level. But that reactor design never went forward. And so it's not one of those, 50 or so that are currently under active development today. Mm,
okay. Thank you for clarifying that. I do want to let our audience know I've got links to these studies. And I think actually I think I have a link to your I see it as 2011, an earlier report that you updated in 2021. So I have links to both of those on alaskapublic.org/hometown. Just scale down to the links section. And people can read more about that. I'm going to share our phone number one more time and then hope to get to some of the findings in your reports and let Dr. Jackson also comment on those. So if you have questions for our experts, 550-8433 in Anchorage. I'm checking our email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And statewide, the number is 1-888-353-5752. I guess I'm thinking when I think about your study, Gwen, I'm thinking that there were some recommendations that you came through. And I was thinking maybe I would hold off on those a little bit and bring Rochelle's study forward because of the five scenarios that she discussed on how, micro or small scale nuclear energy might be deployed in different areas around the state of Alaska. So I just think I'm going to ask you, Rochelle, to jump in here and to the best of you can to kind of just give us an overview of what you were looking at. The small rural village, the hub community, the rail belt scenario, military installations, and then again, remote mining. So I'm going to put you on the spot, Rochelle, and let you talk to us about those a little bit.
Yeah, so the goal of our project was to kind of quantify and contextualize the energy market in Alaska and relate how energy technology choices are made and kind of connect that with what that would look like if a micronuclear reactor was installed or if a community was looking at a micronuclear reactor. The challenges in that is that the energy market in Alaska is incredibly diverse. So what we did was we kind of divided it into baskets, recognizing that every community and every energy producer has their own unique basket of challenges. But what we looked at was kind of a small rural community. So those are those very, very small communities where 1 megawatt of energy production is huge for their kind of average energy demands at any given point. And then we looked at rural hub communities. So that's your Nome or your Kotzebue, where they're still rural, still remote, mostly run off of diesel systems, although integrating renewables at increasing rates. But they have larger system demands. They have hospitals that need power and whatnot. And then your rail belt integration. So that's where you have a huge hundreds of megawatts of power on the system. And micro reactors would be just a drop in that or small modular reactors would just be a drop in that. And then you have your kind of industrial needs. You know, military bases use a lot of power, and they're looking for solutions outside of their current mix of fossil fuels. And mining operations are another one that we looked at, with huge energy demands for processing materials, providing heat and power to their system operations. That by no means is all of the energy in Alaska, but those were definitely the five that we looked at, yeah.
And I think that I also learned, I think it was in your report, Rochelle, that there's something like 30 communities in Alaska that already have hybrids, like they are using diesel and renewable. Of course, Kodiak comes to mind. I believe Kodiak is all on hydro. Do you guys know if that's true?
Nope. Gwen may have a better idea than me, but Kodiak has a very robust mix of hydro and wind, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So already we have communities that are sort of trying to back away from diesel and trying to augment diesel. I think two facts that jump into my mind about the rail belt from reading the report was that is it the Golden Valley Electrical Association meeting the Fairbanks needs relies heavily on coal, and that Anchorage has access to natural gas. So, you know, it sounds like that even sometimes the commodities that are available to energy producers fluctuate in price. And you know, I think, Gwen, when you did the study in 2011, the price of oil was quite a bit different than it is today. And, you know, just trying to figure out, well, would it pencil out, you know, would, you know, at least in terms of the economics. And again, I think it's hard because, you know, the price of oil is not, we don't have control over it, right? So it makes me think about how you have to be poised to act if you need to act, but you don't want to act too soon, partly because of the economics. Something I did read about is the initial cost can be high to get the infrastructure in place. And I was wondering if any of you know whether the current infrastructure bill being considered in the Congress, being promoted by the administration, is actually looking at providing some infrastructure for nuclear. Anybody know anything about that? And I'll start with Gwen, but I'll move through all of you and see if anybody has any sense of that.
Well, I will comment on the Alaska energy market a little bit here, just to kind of complement what Rochelle was talking about, and especially related to the interior here. I mean, there's a couple things why nuclear energy, at least for me, is a really interesting opportunity potentially. And one of those is what you just talked about, Kathleen, in terms of price fluctuation and those versus those upfront capital costs, which like renewable energy often has very high upfront capital costs. But then your long-term, you know, fuel bill, you essentially know what that's going to be, right? If it's wind energy, it's essentially zero. If you're Kodiak Island, you have hydro and wind, you have some operation and maintenance expenses, but you don't have, per se, a fuel cost that you need to worry about in terms of tying that to global energy markets. And that's something that people don't necessarily understand, is that even though we're an oil-producing and exporting state, those oil prices, we don't get a special sweetheart deal on oil prices, especially in our rural communities. Most of that fuel is imported from actually outside of the United States. A lot of it comes from Canada. It's not Alaska oil, and we certainly don't get some kind of a hometown discount for that. Secondly, you know, a lot of our energy costs, especially in the interior, like Golden Valley, I'm up here in the interior. We have extremely high heating costs too. Heating is a really big part of our energy needs in Alaska in general, and especially in some of our, you know, colder climate areas. And this spring in particular has been a pretty darn cold spring for us here. And that's one thing that's especially appealing about nuclear energy, because you have this potential not just to provide baseload electric power that could actually backstop renewables as well, but it has a tremendous amount of potential to provide and serve our heating needs in the state. And that's a really big deal for us here, and that's what is appealing for me about nuclear energy versus something like solar energy, which is not going to be available when we have those high heating and electric loads, in the winter months. But looking at like the infrastructure bill and some of the work that's being done at the national level, I'm going to guess that Dr. Jackson might be in the best position to sort of speak to that.
Dr. Jackson, shortly after you speak, Dr. Jackson, we need to take a tiny break, but go ahead. Anything to offer on the national perspective on that infrastructure bill?
I actually don't. I'm embarrassed to say I have not reviewed the infrastructure bill, and so I'm not aware of anything nuclear in it.
Okay. That was probably not a fair question. I didn't, think of it until this morning. But anyway, we will be right back to talk some more about Alaska. And I certainly want to give Dr. Jackson more chances to talk a little bit about micronuclear and small-scale nuclear. So you are listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. We're talking about nuclear power and how it might answer some of Alaska's future needs, recognizing that a lot of technology has developed. It's not what we maybe thought of as these giant nuclear power plants. In fact, the technology has advanced, and Gwen even talked a little bit about the proposal in Galena shaping some of the discussion, the idea that, hey, maybe instead of giant nuclear power plants, we might be able to benefit from small, contained power units that are mobile. One thing we haven't mentioned here today is, like a natural disaster crisis where, perhaps the power grid is destroyed, and the idea of these mobile units that might be able to be moved into a disaster area. That's another interesting thing that we just haven't mentioned. Our guests again are Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, Rochelle Johnson with the UA Center for Economic Development, and Dr. John Jackson, who is with the Idaho National Lab, and he is the technical director for the micronuclear development program there. I guess I have one question. Do you think we have dealt sufficiently with the nuclear waste issue? Because we did talk about it. We talked about, self-containment in these micronuclear units. But I think I saw a headline where, they still have not resolved Yucca Mountain as a place, 80 miles outside of Las Vegas, which would become a national storage place. But then this discussion is modified by the idea that perhaps spent nuclear waste can be recycled and reused. So I'm going to go to you, Dr. Jackson. Have we dealt with that sufficiently? Are we up to speed with have we told our audience what they need to know about where we are with nuclear waste?
Well, so this is a difficult question, but from my perspective, there's always going to be a question regardless of what we do. I know that the right entities are looking into potential solutions. From our part, from the technical products side, I do feel that we've made significant advances in technology. That I referenced before. But to be perfectly honest, I think people will always have a question about waste. So.
Mm-hmm. But we can't just erase it off the board and say, taken care of. It's always going to be there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One point that I, to Gwen, and I've got a caller here that we're going to try to welcome onto the show in a moment. You talked about it's not just power, it's also heat that comes from these small-scale nuclear technology. And I was reading that what is it called, heat districts? Like some countries like Iceland and Greenland and Finland and Far East Russia have built out these heat districts as a way of capturing that heat. And I guess my question for you is we're talking about home heating here, but would we be talking about warming soil for agriculture? I mean, help me understand what the heat district idea is and if that's part of the infrastructure going in, or is it something that can be developed as the nuclear energy is available? And going to Gwen on that.
Yeah. Thanks, Kathleen. No, I think this is what you're talking about here is actually district heating systems. And this is something that's really commonly used in a lot of countries around the world as a way to sort of centrally produce heat and then distribute that out to users, in individual homes or businesses or at industry hubs or something like that. So Iceland would be an example where they're using geothermal energy that's locally produced. You have hot water coming out of the ground that's distributed via pipeline to houses and different businesses. And that's one way of sort of distributing heat energy as a resource. Now, in Alaska, we actually have a number of these already in place. Downtown Fairbanks has a district heating system. The military bases in the interior at Eielson and Wainwright, Fort Wainwright, have district heating systems that are steam-based district heating systems using coal, energy from the coal plant, steam generated by the coal, by using coal. And the same thing at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, we also have a district heating system. And many of these power plants in the interior, you could actually think of them as a heat plant that produces electricity as a secondary product. That's not the primary product. The primary product is actually producing heat. And one of the reasons, like I mentioned, that nuclear is appealing is that it can provide a really excellent source of heat, whether that's steam or hot water, for a community or a military base. The issue is that unlike some of these other countries like Iceland, we haven't really developed many of these, the infrastructure needed to actually distribute heat in this way. In most cases, beyond, you've got obviously the natural gas system, in Anchorage, but most communities, most rural places, heating is really done on an individual basis by every individual structure or a couple of structures maybe. And so that's an additional potential cost or challenge that we have to overcome, is that if we want to use heat from a nuclear power plant for space heating, we would also have to build out infrastructure to be able to distribute that heat to individual customers in ways that we just don't have right now, except for these few examples in the interior that I mentioned.
Gotcha. Okay. And I'd like to welcome a caller, Mark. Hi, Mark, onto Hometown Alaska. You have a you have a very basic question. When is this technology going to be available? Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. And I really appreciate Gwen's comment about the need for both electric and thermal loads. So, yeah, my question is simply, do we have some sort of a guess or speculation on when the small reactors may be commercially available? Or are we talking 5 years, 10 years? Does anybody want to venture a guess?
Okay. I'm going to go to Dr. Jackson first, just because you're on the side of developing these micronuclear systems. So when might they be commercial?
So that's a great question, and the answer is within the next decade. If you read the mission vision statement for the DOE's microreactor program, it's that by 2025, we'll have demonstrations of multiple domestic commercial microreactor concepts. And so everything we do is focused on supporting that vision. We of course are agnostic from the point of view of developers that we support, and we look for opportunities to de-risk technology for them. But we're also very, very heavily focused, in coordination with the National Reactor Innovation Center and the GAIN initiative, the Gateway for Accelerated Innovation in Nuclear, in leveraging national laboratory resources for support, particularly for the National Reactor Innovation Center, for support of demonstrations of these, because we recognize that in order to take this to the next level, we need to have something you can put your hands on, so to speak, and you can kick the tires and see it in action. That's where the real rubber meets the road, and we expect to do that within the very near time frame.
You know, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. We're the clock is ticking down. But one of the things I wanted to touch on was I read in I forget if it's the report that out of Gwen's think tank or out of Rochelle's, but that there are three companies have specific interest in the Alaska market: NuScale, Oklo, and UltraSafe Nuclear Corporation. And actually, let me jump to Okla, which was really interesting. I think that there's a sense that we might see something as a test here soon from Okla in Alaska. The thing that's interesting about Okla is it's a Silicon Valley startup. They have something called the Aurora. And they've had a long interest in Alaska. So it might be Gwen. We only have probably 2 or 3 minutes left, Gwen.
Yeah.
What we might see first here in Alaska, even if it's on a trial basis?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are, Oklo is a company that has had a longstanding interest in the Alaska market. They are actually part of the Launch Alaska family of companies. So they have been working with Alaskans for a long time, but they are not necessarily the leader in these microreactor technologies. There are a number of different manufacturers. You mentioned UltraSafe. There's others as well that are quite interested in Alaska as a potential early adopter. I would venture to guess that if we were going to see a reactor tested in Alaska anytime in the next, say, 5 years, it would probably be under something that's being done under the Strategic Capabilities Office at the Department of Defense under this program called Project Pele, which Oklo is not participating in, where they are trying to build and design and test a transportable nuclear reactor. Alaska has been talked about. One of our defense locations may be a potential site to test that kind of a technology. But I agree with Dr. Jackson that, you know, in the next decade, we are going to see these things start to really become potentially commercially available. And I do think that this is something that we need to be thinking about and have a strategy in Alaska for how we want to address whether we want nuclear energy to be part of our future mix, whether that's on the rail belt, our military installations, or in rural parts of the state.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to remind folks, if this topic has piqued your interest, go to alaskapublic.org/hometown. We have links to the studies that were done by these two think tanks in Alaska. And we also have a link to the public event that you could join by Zoom on Thursday, April 15th, from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. And I think Launch Alaska is going to be a part of that, as well as I think both of Gwen and Rochelle. So it's just the beginning of this conversation, and I hope I get to see the benefits of the work here in Alaska. So I do send you we didn't get to Gwen's recommendations for the state, but they are on our website. And I do have to say thank you to our callers and listeners today. Also, thank you to Gwen Holdman, Executive Director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, Rochelle Johnson from the UA Center for Economic Development at the UAA Alaska Enterprise Institute, and Dr. John Jackson, National Technical Director for the Department of Energy Microreactor Program at the Idaho National Laboratory. Next Monday, Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska will return with an episode. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Emmert was our audio engineer today. Thanks so much for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.